Good morning. This morning's scripture reading is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 8. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead, but he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened.
Good morning. It's me again. I grew up about a three-hour drive from Chicago, and Chicago was kind of the place we would go to every once in a while to get a big city experience. And it turned out that Chicago had a lot of things that Kalamazoo, Michigan didn't have. One of the things that Chicago had was graffiti. And I remember on one occasion, this is many years ago, but the image has stuck with me. I remember seeing some graffiti on a billboard somewhere outside of Chicago. And the billboard is a white billboard with black lettering. And it said, "Jesus is the answer." That's what the billboard originally said. And somebody had come along and added to it with some graffiti. Maybe an atheist gang or something. I don't know who does graffiti. But somebody came, said, "Jesus is the answer." And then underneath it, in spray-painted lettering, it said, "What's the question?" And that image, as I said, has sort of stuck with me for many years. And I really like it. I just really like that image. And I actually think, if I could be so bold, that I think Jesus might like it too. Jesus asks a lot of questions. He asks a lot of questions. He asks a lot more questions than he answers. And most of the time when he asks a question, he's actually not even looking for an answer. But instead, he's asking questions in order to reveal something about us or about himself. Jesus apparently believes that it's not enough to have answers. He wants us to understand the questions. You know, a student can steal the answer sheet to a test and ace the test, but not understand any of the questions. And it's the same with Jesus. You and I can be around Christianity our whole lives, and we can know all the right things to say about what we believe, but it's not enough to be able to say the right creedal formulations. Jesus wants us to understand the questions. To understand the questions. That's the premise for our series this summer. That's why we've been looking all summer at some of the big questions that Jesus asks. And there's a lot of them, so we can't do all of them, but we're doing 9 of the big ones. And some of these are so good, like this morning's question, some of these are just such simple questions on the face of it. But when you start to unpack it, you realize that they're such deep, provocative questions. And that's true of the question we're looking at this morning. The question this morning is, "Who touched me?" Who touched me? It's a remarkable question that Jesus asks. It's a very personal question that Jesus asks, and we'll see that. And it comes in the middle of a remarkable story, a very telling story about the person of Jesus. This is one of my favorite stories about Jesus. To be honest, the story itself is so much better than anything I can really say about it. It's the story of two females. Both of them are seriously ill, but there's an interesting contrast between these two females. One of them is an older woman who's been sick for a long time. She's been sick for 12 years, and there's no cure. The other one is a young girl. She's only 12 years old, and she's been sick for a very short time, but she's dying. So this woman has a chronic condition, and the girl has a very acute condition. And in Jesus is on his way to heal this dying girl at the request of her father, Jairus. He's on his way to heal this dying girl. You know, it's an emergency situation. They're going as fast as they can to get there. It's an EMT situation. And along the way, Jesus stops. He stops to engage with this woman. You can only imagine what Jairus, what this girl's father must be thinking as Jesus stops. I mean, as the story opens, Jairus is pleading with Jesus to help him. Jairus is pleading with Jesus to help heal his daughter. And when Jesus agrees to do that, I mean, Jairus must have suddenly been filled with a new sense of hope. His daughter's dying. I mean, maybe he had already given up on his daughter. We don't know. But now all of a sudden, Jairus has a whole new sense of hope. And his only fear is that they won't get there too late. And they're rushing to get there. And along the way, Jesus stops to engage with this woman. And this woman has a chronic condition. It's a very sad condition, but she's lived with it for 12 years. I mean, surely she could have survived another couple of hours. And yet, Jesus is on his way to heal a dying girl, and he stops to deal with this woman. And while they're talking, Jairus' worst fear comes true. His daughter dies. His daughter dies. And you can imagine what Jairus is thinking. I mean, this is totally ridiculous on Jesus' part. Jesus lets a little girl die so that he could deal with somebody who could have very easily waited. It's completely irrational. It's actually worse than irrational. It's malpractice. It's malpractice on the part of Jesus, the great physician. Well, there's a lot we could look at in this story, and we'll get to some of it. But our focal point this morning is on the question Jesus asked that triggered that delay, that triggered the delay that caused this girl to die. The question is, who touched me? Who touched me? And we're going to use that question to make one big observation about the person of Jesus. We'll make one big observation about Jesus this morning, and then we'll spend all of our time unpacking that statement. So the observation is, Jesus can be touched by someone who reaches out in faith. I think we can put that up there in case you'd rather read it than hear me say it. Jesus can be touched by someone who reaches out in faith. So we'll spend our time unpacking that. And to start with, let's break that statement in two and look first at the first half of it. Jesus can be touched. I mean, I know that's sort of stating the obvious, but to me, that's the most stunning thing that this question illuminates for us. Who touched me? Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God, can be touched. He can be touched by us. He can be moved. He feels. Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God, can be moved by us. And in particular, what we see here in this story is he can be moved by our suffering. I love what this says about the person of Jesus, that Jesus is so in tune. Jesus Christ is so hardwired to be in tune with our suffering, that when someone who's in pain reaches out and touches him, power just goes out of him automatically. That's how in tune he is with our pain and with our suffering. And he stops, even though he's in the middle of something pretty important, he stops to engage with this suffering woman. He's on his way to heal a dying girl, and he stops to engage with this woman who's suffering. That in and of itself says something remarkable about God, which is that God can be interrupted. God can be interrupted. Jesus is on his way to do something really important, and yet he can be interrupted. And that explains the difference between Jesus Christ and Matt Scogan, or at least one of the many differences. See, I get up every day, and I know exactly what I'm going to do that day. I get up every morning and I know exactly what I have to get done that day. And I don't tolerate interruptions very well. And I mean, look, I work at a bank. My full-time job is at a bank. I'm never doing anything that's a life and death situation. I'm never doing anything during the day that remotely compares with Jesus' mission to save the world. Or even his task at hand in this story to save a dying girl. I work at a bank, and yet if I'm in the middle of something, if I know what I want to get done that day, I just don't tolerate interruptions very well. But here's Jesus, and he shows that he can be interrupted. He can be interrupted by us. He can be interrupted by us reaching out to touch him. I mean, t- To me, that's stunning. To me, that's remarkable. And if that doesn't inspire you to pray, if that doesn't inspire you to reach out to him, to interrupt him, I don't know what will. There's a great spot in Luke 11 where Jesus is giving instructions on how to pray. And he has this great phrase. He says, you ought to pray shamelessly. Pray shamelessly. The word literally means pray with irreverence. And you say, well, how in the world could Jesus Christ talk about us going into the presence of the holy God irreverently? I mean, that sounds totally inappropriate. But see, whether or not something is inappropriate, whether or not you speaking with someone irreverently is inappropriate, actually depends entirely upon your relationship with that person. Jesus says, I have a family relationship with God, and I want you to have it too. Tonight at 3 o'clock in the morning, who in the world has the right to wake you up and ask you to get them a drink of water? Who has that right? Your neighbors? No way. Your friends? No way, not my friends. Your spouse? Maybe. You know, like if they've had a bad day or they're sick, maybe. But even then, most of us are probably going to say, why don't you get it yourself? But if my three-year-old son, Oliver, comes into the room in the middle of the night and says, Daddy, I need a drink of water. I'll do it. Now, unless Sarah happens to wake up first. But one of us will do it. And we're not going to say, sorry, Oliver, you need to make an appointment. No, we do it. We're his parents. He's our child. He hasn't done anything to earn it from us. We love him. He's our child. He can approach us irreverently anytime about anything. And Jesus says, I can give you access to God that's like that. I can give you access to God that's like that so that you can approach him irreverently anytime about anything. How in the world could we not want to take him up on that? The God of the universe has a 24/7 open door policy. How could we not want to take him up on that? Well, that's what this woman does in this story. This woman reaches out sort of irreverently and touches Jesus. And he responds. He honors it. Now, what's interesting to note here, and it's actually a pretty important point in this story, is that when this woman reaches out, Jesus is in the middle of a pretty intense crowd. There's people all around him. Luke actually says that the crowds are almost crushing him. You know, there's people throwing themselves at him. Everybody wants a piece of Jesus. Everybody's trying to get something from him. They all want a miracle. They all want to be right next to him. And I don't know, for me, this is a little bit scary. For me, this says that it's possible for us to be right next to Jesus our whole lives. We can be right next to him and yet not really connect with him. We can be studying him. We can be talking about him. We can come to church. We can be inspired by him and yet not really connect with him. The difference is faith. And that's what Jesus says here. He says, it was your faith that healed her. It was her faith that healed her. It was her faith that allowed her to connect with him. There's people all around him, and yet she's the only one who really connects with him. And the difference was faith. So let's look at that. Remember, our premise this morning is Jesus can be touched by someone who reaches out in faith. So what does that mean? What does faith mean? How do I get that faith? How can I reach out in faith? Well, that's a giant topic. We could do a whole sermon series on faith. But this morning, I want to pull out three faith lessons that we can glean from Jesus' interaction with this woman. Three faith lessons that I think are relatively practical that we can glean from his interaction with this woman. And the first faith lesson we see, the first thing we see about faith from this woman is that her faith is desperate. It's desperate. Luke says that she'd been sick for 12 years and no one could help her. The version of this story that occurs in Mark says that she had suffered under the care of many doctors, and it actually points out that she spent all her money trying to get better. So this woman has tried everything. She's tried everything, and she's finally reached a point where nobody else can help her. She can't help herself. She can't spend money to solve this problem. No doctor can help her. No other person can help her. Nothing in the world can help her. She's completely desperate. She's realizing finally that the only hope she has is Jesus. She's reaching out to him in desperation. And that's the first step for us. See, the first step for us to have faith in Jesus is sort of a negative step. The first step for us to have faith in Jesus is admitting that we're desperate, we're hopeless, we're completely weak, unless we have Jesus intervening in our lives. And you know, the problem with us is that we are so full of pride that we refuse to admit how much we need him. I mean, God himself has offered to be interrupted by us, to be interrupted by us if we reach out in faith, in desperation. How could we not want to take him up on that? And yet we refuse to admit how much we need him. And New Yorkers are especially guilty of this. I mean, we New Yorkers are activists. We're action-oriented people. We want to spring into action. Whenever there's a crisis or a problem, we want to jump into action. And most of us deep down don't really believe that reaching out to God is doing anything active. Most of us deep down don't really believe that prayer is doing anything active. You know, I've got real problems in my life, and I got to figure this out. I got to solve these problems. Our world has real problems. I mean, look at the headlines we've faced just this summer. I mean, we've got real issues in this country with terrorism, or with racism and terrorism and violence and all kinds of senseless killing. We've got real issues in this country with generational poverty and this whole conversation around economic mobility and income inequality. And you and I read about those things and we experience those things and we think something has to be done. Something has to be done. We can't. There's real issues here with racism and racially motivated violence. We can't let this continue. And we think something's got to be done. Let's spring into action. Let's start an activist campaign. And you know, we need to do that. We have to do that. Jesus is unequivocal that we have to do whatever we can to promote social justice. And the church ought to be leading the charge on that. But what would it look like? What would it look like if we really believed that the most activist, action-oriented thing we could possibly do was to first seek God's intervention through prayer? What would it look like? I mean, the reality is, if you or I were made king or queen for a day, none of us really know how to solve these complicated big issues. If any of us was made king or queen for a day, we have no clue how to really tackle these issues. And, you know, there's nobody in City Hall who has any idea how to get at these problems. There's nobody in Albany. There's nobody in Washington, D.C. There's nobody running for office who has any clue how to really get at these issues. But I have a hunch. I have a hunch that God could figure it out. And what would it look like? What would it look like if we got desperate enough to plead for him to intervene? I don't know. I mean, the honest answer is I don't know, but I'd love to see what would happen. I'd love to see us try. Now, look, I get it. I get it. We're busy. We're busy people. Who really has time to pray? Who really has time to spend quality time in prayer? Well, I love what Eugene Peterson says. I'm convicted by it, but I love it. He says, the person who claims to be too busy to pray is actually a lazy person. In our busyness, we're procrastinating and avoiding the real work of prayer. You hear that? Person who's too busy is procrastinating and avoiding your real work. Martin Luther was once asked what he was going to do the following day, and he responded with this. I love this too. He says, I'm going to work. I'm going to work from early until late. In fact, I have so much to do that I shall need to spend the first 3 hours of my day in prayer. Martin Luther saying, I'm so busy that the only way I'm going to get through all this is if I spend the first 3 hours of my day in prayer. When was the last time you told yourself that? When was the last time you said, I have so much going on tomorrow that the only way I'm possibly going to get through all this is if I spend the first 3 hours of my day in prayer? Martin Luther's a pretty busy guy. He's leading a spiritual revolution. He's pastoring, he's preaching, he's writing, he's translating the Bible into German. He's a dad and a husband. And yet in his busiest times, he's saying, I can't get anything done unless I spend the first 3 hours in prayer. Why is he saying that? Because he's desperate. He's desperate. He knows that he can't get anything done, at least not anything that really matters, unless he is desperately seeking God's intervention in his life and in his work. Prayer is not a therapeutic distraction from your work. Prayer is not a relief from your work. It can be those things, but ultimately prayer is your work. It's the most important part of your work. If you reach out to God in desperation, he shows us in this story that he'll respond. How could we not take him up on that? Okay, that's the first thing we learn about faith from this woman. She reaches out desperately and Jesus honors it. She reaches out in desperation and Jesus honors it. The second lesson we learn about faith here is that it's not the strength of her faith that matters. It's the direction of it and the fact that she acts on it. It's not the strength of your faith that matters, it's the direction of your faith and acting on it. And Jesus wants this whole crowd to see this. He He wants this whole crowd to see and understand this, which is one of the reasons why he asks this question. Who touched me? I mean, maybe he didn't know who touched him. I don't know. I find that hard to believe. But what's clear is he wants everybody there to know who touched him and to understand what happened and why. He wants everybody there to know something that's profoundly important about faith, which is that it's not the strength of your faith that will heal you. It's the direction of it and acting on it. This woman, it turns out, had a pretty weak, flawed faith. She has this sort of weird, superstitious understanding of Jesus where she thinks she can just touch his cloak and then get out of there with a healing. It's treating Jesus like he's a magician or a sorcerer, not a savior. Jesus, of course, wants an intimate relationship, and he won't let her escape without that. But he does honor the fact that even though her faith is sort of weak and flawed, it's pointed in the right direction. She knows that Jesus can help her, and she acts on that. And it's a big deal that she acts on that. See, one thing you need to know about this story is that it's actually illegal for her to be in this crowd. Anybody who was sick or had leprosy or who was bleeding was considered unclean and wouldn't be allowed to be in public places like this. So it's illegal for her to be in this crowd. And not only is she showing up in this crowd, but then she's reaching out to touch a rabbi. She's committing some pretty enormous social taboos here. She's taking a big risk, but she wants to take the risk because she knows Jesus can help her. And that's what Jesus honors. It's a weak, sort of superstitious faith, but she knows Jesus can help her, and she acts on it. She takes a risk and acts on it. You can look at your own faith, and you can say, I mean, my faith is so weak. My faith is so filled with doubts. God will never hear my prayers. It's so filled with doubts. But what Jesus shows here is it doesn't matter how doubtful it is. It matters the direction of it, not the strength of it. Jesus says in Matthew 17 that if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move, and it will move from here to there. It's not the strength of your faith that's moving the mountain. God's moving the mountain. God's moving the mountain. It's your faith that's connecting you to God, and he's the one doing the work. And it only takes a tiny amount of faith. It only takes a tiny amount of faith to connect you to Jesus. And when Jesus asks this question, who touched me? He takes this woman of a very weak, timid faith, and he turns her into a powerful public witness. I love that. I love that. So that's the second thing we learn about faith. It's not the strength of it, it's the direction of it and acting on it. The third and final observation about faith or faith lesson, we're going to switch characters and look at what Jairus has to learn about faith while Jesus stops to converse with this woman. Jairus undergoes a test of faith that goes way beyond what he expected to have to endure here. And Jairus learns something pretty important about faith. What Jairus learns about faith here is that faith is believing in Jesus, not believing in our agenda for him. See, there's a pretty important distinction there. Faith is actually believing in Jesus, not believing in what we want Jesus to do. Jairus says, "Help me, Jesus. Help me now. Hurry, hurry. My daughter's dying." And Jesus says, I won't be hurried. I won't be hurried. And when his daughter dies, Jesus looks him in the eye and says, just believe. Believe in me. It doesn't matter what the circumstances look like to you. I need you to trust me. I need you to trust me and believe in me. Faith is believing in him, not in our agenda for him. And Jesus won't be hurried. You know, I like to point out that Jesus walked everywhere. He walked everywhere. Now you say, of course he walked everywhere. There's no other way to get around. But for one thing, he could have picked any point in human history in which to come. There's a verse in Galatians that says Jesus came in the fullness of time. In other words, Jesus came at the ideal point in human history, and he came at a time when you could only get places on foot. He didn't come today with our communication and our transportation and our devices. He came at a time when you could only get places on foot. And not only that, but he's just never in a hurry. I mean, he never runs. He never blows somebody off because he's running late for something. He's never double booked. He never seems panicked. He's just always doing things according to his own sense of timing. He's always doing things according to his own plan, his own agenda. And it doesn't matter what things look like for us. He wants us to trust in him and to trust in his sense of timing and his agenda. Have you ever met somebody who said, I used to have faith in God, but he's let me down too many times? I used to have faith in God, but he's let me down too many times. Well, the reality is that person didn't really have faith in God. That person had faith in their own agenda, which they were hoping God would implement for them. But that's not faith in God at all. That's not faith in Jesus at all. And you and I can look at a lot of situations in our lives and all around the world, and we can say, I can't think of any reason why God would delay in solving this problem. Or I can't think of any reason why God would have allowed this to occur in the first place. But how do we know? We don't have full information. We don't have full information. Only God does. God sees everything, and he says, I need you to trust me. I need you to just believe in me, not in what you want me to do, but I need you to believe in me. And ultimately, what's great, and we see it in this story, is that Jesus has something far better planned for both of these characters than either of them asked of him. I mean, Jairus, look at Jairus. Jairus comes to Jesus asking for a healing, and he gets a resurrection. There's only three times in the New Testament when Jesus does this, and Jairus' daughter gets one of them. And this woman comes to Jesus hoping to get cured and then get out of there. But she gets a personal interaction with the Son of God, and she gets a shout out from him where Jesus is saying to this whole crowd, look at this woman's faith. And here we are 2,000 years later still talking about her. Both of these characters got far more from Jesus than they asked him for, and it was far better than what they thought they were asking for. Now, the other side of that coin is they had to give a lot more than they thought they were going to have to give. I mean, Jairus undergoes this test of faith. It's way beyond anything he thought he was going to have to endure. And this woman, who's hoping to sort of sneak away, is forced to go public with her faith. But ultimately, what we see here is that Jesus is going to give them far more than they asked for. He's going to expect far more than they asked for, but he's going to give them far more than they asked for. And that's why we can trust in him. That's why we can trust in him. See, this story actually gives us a pretty full picture of how faith will manifest itself. And the problem is, the picture isn't always pretty. I mean, you'll meet some Christians who seem to believe that with the right amount of faith and the right kind of faith, you can always call on God to intervene immediately and smooth out life's troubles. That's not how it works. It's certainly not how it works in this story. Jairus undergoes some pretty dark hours when Jesus lets his daughter die. And for some of us, for Jairus, it's literally only a matter of hours. For some of us, it may be years of suffering, or perhaps even a whole lifetime of suffering. But we cannot assume that anybody who is suffering, that's somehow a reflection on their faith. No way, that's preposterous. I mean, throughout Jesus' lifetime, he raises 3 people from the dead, 4 if you include himself. And he performs healings on between 30 and 40 occasions. But he leaves thousands of people in the grave and thousands of people sick. And we can't possibly assume that behind all those people he didn't heal, that there weren't people of great faith. No way, that's crazy. The only thing we can really assume, based on the promises of the Bible, is that God had something else in mind, something better in mind for all of them. The premise we started with this morning is that Jesus can be touched by someone who reaches out in faith. And the Bible promises that that's true, that Jesus will respond, that God will respond if we reach out in faith. But of course, it never promises that he'll respond in ways we want him to or ask him to. This is the whole point of this last section, that sometimes we may get a miracle from him. Sometimes we may reach out and he'll intervene in a dramatic, supernatural way. But other times, he may simply give you the ability to endure suffering with hope and joy. Perhaps that's an even bigger miracle. The great chapter in the Bible on faith is found in Hebrews 11. And it starts with a famous verse that maybe you've heard before. The verse says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And then it goes on, and over the course of this chapter, it lists some of the great heroes of the faith, some of the great heroes of the Old Testament. And then the chapter ends with 8 verses that are often overlooked, but they're so good. They're so good, and they give us a really balanced picture of how faith can manifest itself. And I'm going to close with these 8 verses. It starts by saying, this is verse 33. Again, it's listed all these great heroes of the faith. And then it says, by faith, they conquered kingdoms. They performed acts of righteousness. They obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight, and women received back their dead by resurrection. So if we stop there, you'd get a very one-sided view of faith. If you stop there, you get a very distorted view of faith, because that makes it sound like faith always wins in this life. That makes it sound like faith always wins in this life. But then it goes on. And then you get the other side of it. Then it says, by faith, others were tortured, not accepting release, in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, even also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and in holes in the ground. All of these gained approval through their faith. Sometimes God will respond. We can reach out and touch him, and sometimes he'll intervene in a dramatic, supernatural way and do a healing or a miracle. But other times we'll reach out and he'll simply give you the joy and the hope so that you can endure suffering. And that may be just as big a miracle. That may be just as big a miracle. The Bible never says that with faith all your problems will go away. But the Bible does promise that when we reach out in faith, he will respond. He will intervene somehow. He will hear your prayers and he will intervene somehow. And what he wants us to do is trust him, trust his response, because he knows us better than we know ourselves. He loves us better than we love ourselves. And ultimately, of course, Jesus has intervened in the most dramatic way we could possibly have imagined or asked for. That's why Jesus never really has to hurry, because on the cross, he's intervened in order to solve all our problems, to definitively deal with all sickness, with death itself, and with our sin, which is the only thing that could really take us down. And that's why through faith, we can reach out and connect with God, and we can take his hand and let him guide us through whatever perfect agenda he has in store for your lives. Let's pray. Father, thank you that through faith we can reach out and touch you, that we can approach you irreverently, we can interrupt you anytime about anything. I pray, Father, that we would not be so filled with pride that we refuse to take you up on that amazing offer to interrupt and engage with you. I pray that you would help us build our faith, that you'd help us realize our desperate need for you, that only you can help us. Father, I pray that you'd give us assurance that it's the direction of our faith and acting on it that matters more than the strength of our faith, that even faith as small as a mustard seed can connect us with you. And finally, Lord, I pray that you would give us the ability to trust you and your plan, not our plans, but your plans. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen.